Good afternoon. I'll now call this meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:38 p.m. on Tuesday, April 30, 2024. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Present today is Senator Lukey Tobin and Senator Rob Myers, as well as myself, Chair James Kaufman. Staffing the committee today is our LIO moderator, Dylan Williams, and Marigwyn Kawakami from Records. My Transportation Committee aide is Emma Torkelson. Everyone, please silence your cell phones. And for today's agenda, we have three items. We have first SB 263, Roads and Highways Advisory Board Improvement Program by the Senate Transportation Committee. Then we'll hear HB 395, Transfer of Railroad Property by the House Transportation Committee. And all right. So first, we'll take up Senate Bill 263 by the Senate Transportation Committee, the second hearing of SB 263. Today, it is my intention to consider a committee substitute and take questions from the committee members. So do committee members have any questions before we consider the committee substitute? All right, so noted. So the amendment deadline for SB 263 was Monday the 22nd. My office received amendments that were incorporated into a committee substitute version B. After receiving some feedback and suggestions from the Department of Transportation late last week, we have drafted some new committee substitute version S. Version S incorporates the original changes and some of the changes requested by the department. So, Senator Myers, can I get a motion to adopt the committee substitute as our working document?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move that we adopt the Transportation Committee substitute for Senate Bill 263, Work Order 33-LS1460/Sierra as our working document.
Thank you, and I'll object for the purpose of discussion and invite Matthew Harvey, staff to the Senate Transportation Committee, to the table to take us through the summary of changes.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Kaufman. For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to the Senate Transportation Committee, and Senator Kaufman. And just walking through the explanation and changes for SB 263, bill version A to S, adds new section 1, which adds language clarifying the Metropolitan Planning Organizations, or MPOs, must be established by agreement between the governor and local governments. It revises language in 44.42.053A to clarify the development cadence and to add intermodal. Adds language requiring that the STIP incorporate, without change, applicable tribal transportation programs, federal lands transportation programs, or federal lands access programs. On page 2, line 25, through page 3, line 3, adds language stating that agreements between the state and MPOs relating to foundational structure or roles and responsibilities must be made available on the internet website. Moves the distribution list for STIP submissions and changes this to a new subsection F. Replaces the designated board seats for public members from specific judicial districts with the requirement that the board must consist of at least 2 members from each judicial district. Also adds 1 member who is a community leader residing in the unorganized borough. Adds language clarifying terms of members appointed to fill vacancies. Adds the requirement that the board adopt bylaws, including guidelines for the board operations, and revises the pre-construction review process for the board by requiring that the department submit to the board a list of projects that have been in the pre-construction phase for at least 8 years, allowing the board to request a presentation from the department on any listed project, providing clarity that the board may issue project recommendations following the presentation, and requiring that the recommendations are submitted to the included distribution list.
Thank you, Mr. Harvey. Do we have any questions from the committee? Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Harvey, my question is having to do with that list of projects in pre-construction on page 4. If I remember right, the initial draft of the bill started with projects that have been there for 3 years. DOT said, well, that's a lot because they sometimes stay there a while. So the draft we had last week was 5 years, and now we're at 8 years. And I'm starting to wonder if we go out to 8 years, if that is so dang far out as to almost make it kind of pointless, that we're trying to, you know, keep tabs on these things and making sure that we're putting our time and our effort in places where it's going to bear fruit. if by the time it gets to 8 years, still in pre-construction, if we've, you know, that ship has kind of sailed by that point, we need to tamp that back down.
So, please respond.
For the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Kaufman. Through the chair to Senator Myers, the extension from 5 to 8 was at the request of DOT, and so I might ask DOT to comment on that specifically.
Yes, please, Mr. Chair.
Okay, yes, and so, Mr. Mills, if you would, please come up, place yourself on the record.
And for the record, Andy Mills, legislative liaison for the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities. And through the chair, Senator Myers, the request for the increase in time was a reflection of trying to get the resourcing level that was upon review needed for the type of activity that the language called for. So every few years, everything in pre-construction is a very long list. And so we imagine the possibility, as we've seen with other boards, such as MHOB, a significant increase in requested workload by staff to provide what is requested of the board. And again, the language does call for us to staff and take care of the board's request, which we would happily do. But the resourcing of that necessitated both the fiscal note that we provided and making sure folks understood what that workload would look like. 5 years for pre-construction. Pre-construction actually, by the way, is an undefined term in this case. We could interpret it a couple different ways. Does it include the planning process or not? Does it start at environmental? It can be cut a couple different ways. So I think we would look to clarify that with the board on when that phase starts. Either way, it's quite a few projects. And for these purposes, we were trying to make sure 5 years is not a very long time frame in DOT's world. We certainly wish right-of-way acquisition and other pieces of the pre-construction phase went faster, but there are limitations to that make 5 years a very substantial list of projects to review. You'd effectively have everything on the table, so that's why we recommended a longer time frame. 10 years is the staleness review for Fed, so we were trying to split the difference.
Follow up?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I guess one thing that I've kind of been picking up on with DOT since my time in office is that it just seems like DOT does a lot of planning, that some of it is good stuff that, you know, gets us some good projects. Some of it gets thrown by the wayside, and we could potentially be saving ourselves some money, saving ourselves some time, and honestly providing some better transparency to the public. If we could cut down on how many of those plans we're doing and say, oh, okay, well, we identify a need, we create a plan for it, and instead of saying, well, we're going to create 4 plans for something and one of them, you know, maybe one of them will get built eventually. I can understand right-of-way acquisition and, you know, some other legal things that could drag some of these things out, but it worries me if we're going to give DOT that long of a leash before we check up on them and make sure that the things that we're spending time on in the planning side are actually going to possibly bear fruit in the construction and actual use side.
Senator Myers, can you boil that down to a question?
Working on it, Mr. Chair.
You need time?
I'm going to have to take a little bit of time.
I know what it's like to have a concern and be looking for the questions. So take a break. Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is actually in the same section. So trying to keep us well organized. I understand that this section was particularly around a discussion that happened in Anchorage. That's why I was very interested in ensuring that there was an opportunity to evaluate projects repeatedly and episodically so that we could have good community input and to provide that avenue and pathway. So I too have reservations about the 8 years because I think within regards to using one of the examples that was brought forth, 92nd Avenue, that 8 years would not have provided that opportunity for that repetitive community input. So it might be just too long of a horizon. Additionally, on that same page, right below that section, line 23, the board may request a presentation from a department on any listed project. And I think I I have concerns about the phrase any listed project, because again, what if 92nd Avenue, as an example, was not listed? There was ample community feedback and frustration. That flexibility for this group to be nimble and responsive to not only the community, but also to help DOT alleviate any of these issues from boiling up to the point where 92nd Avenue was taken off the tip, is my hope. Is what is the off-ramp that we can provide? What's that off-ramp that we've discussed?
Please respond.
And through the chair, Senator Tobin, I appreciate what you're saying, and we do understand somewhere in there's a magic window, I'm imagining, and there are certainly some very good examples. I think it's a resourcing question for the department, less than it is for the policy call on you. What is the cadence and what is that time frame that you would want? I do know, again, maybe just up to the 30,000 foot level, we have seen, and perhaps this has always been, probably has always been, there's an element that we need to be cognizant of, that with some projects can get reviewed or an additional scrutiny because of sort of a heightened political climate around something that isn't necessarily associated. I could suggest some bridges in an area that were not an issue until there was some industry work in the area. And so we certainly always want to be cognizant of what some of the downstream effects can be. However, for DOT, for the agency review, I don't think 8 was a requirement. It was just a suggestion to try and bring, again, the workload potential, because, for instance, it does say May. Well, May could be all of the projects on that list. We may need to present on all of them. And if so, I can certainly would love to have any committee members who want to come to a project evaluation board, a PEB, where we review projects. And that's a subset of a very large list. Certainly that's more in depth, but you could certainly see the workload for volunteers who meet quarterly or more as being quite substantial on this effort. And of course, the staffing resources necessary to prepare all those materials, depending on what they ask for. So that's what we were trying to speak to in the request to review this.
Hello.
Thank you, Mr. Mills. I think that's very helpful. And there might be some massaging language that we can add unless otherwise requested, or if there is public input about a specific project that needs additional evaluation. Not sure what exactly that might look like. I'm not a fan of conceptual amendments, so I will work with the bill sponsor to try to figure out how we might be able to provide some of that flexibility.
Thank you. Mr. Mills, the statement earlier brings up a question. You said that pre-construction is not defined. In the project management world that I came from, we had very tight definitions that would describe the stage that a project was at, referred to as stage gates, and they had names that basically you started at a problem statement, you went through all the conceptual development, the detailed design, and then you ultimately got to a point where you were IFC issued for construction, and there the deliverables that were built during that prior time frame were then you're at a point where you're actually ready to go. Now, there was some nuance around all that. There was a little bit of wiggle room for a variety of reasons around IFCs, but it was pretty well defined. And so are we sure that there's not actually a definition?
Mr. Chairman, I believe we can put a couple different definitions to that, because is it in the strictest of terms where our pre-construction folks are not not the same, at least in the DOT standard, as our planning teams. They work together, but that's in our world a bit different than pre-construction, anything that precedes actual on-the-ground construction. Again, do we initiate it at planning? The clock, does it start at planning? Does it start at environmental? I mean, at what stage gate do we start counting the years? And that will matter for the list of potential projects and timeframe for review. So I would only say you're right that depends on which world we grab it from or which understanding we take. It's not defined here was what I was trying to say.
I guess I'm wondering if that's an opportunity to define it somewhere, and that way there's a more widespread understanding of what that threshold means, or as in the world I came from, what that stage gate means when you're jumping from not constructing to actually constructing with the intellectual property deliverables that were created for the benefit of the project.
So, Mr. Chairman, for instance, if you were to say from the start of design, just spitballing with you, that is a definitive when design starts, as opposed to the planning effort, which can be quite variable depending. So you're right. We could tighten that up.
Well, let's not work it here, but I appreciate the instinct to do so, though. So we can look at that as a question, maybe something that would be helpful to the process. Senator Meyer, has that question crystallized yet?
Mr. Chair, it has not, but I did have another question while Mr. Mills was up here. A little bit different spot. We added some language talking about MPOs and saying that they are going to be created by agreement between the governor and local governments. And I'm just trying to get a little bit more clarity in my mind on how MPOs work. Mentions that an MPO would be in an urbanized area with a population of more than 50,000, already existing statute. How does that not apply to the Kenai Peninsula then? Last I checked, the population of the Kenai borough was somewhere in the neighborhood of 60,000, so that would apply.
Through the chair, Senator Myers, I appreciate this question. We can certainly delve into the world of MPOs. It's fascinating and actually kind of exciting for some of us who are into that. So for this, it's again driven by the census. So every 10 years, a census area would define the window in which it falls, the 50 to 200 and 200 and over. And in this case, I believe that's the census area does not have that over 50 population if you were to look. Otherwise, that would have triggered, as it did with the Matsu borough, the formation of an entity. And so, again, with the U.S. Census is what we can look at. And it's defined fully in 23 CFR and in statutory federal regulations. So we can get you the citations so you can delve into what the actual citations show. But we rely on the census data.
So just to follow up. Just to clarify, so you're saying that it's not based on, for example, an existing government or an existing organized area. It's based on how the Census Bureau breaks down their census areas.
Through the chair, that is correct.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Staying in the same section. So I'm going to read a document that is on BASIS. It is from the Municipality of Anchorage versus the state, 3AN-05-0895ICI, and it states that this is significant because it states that this U.S. code provides that a designation of a metropolitan planning organization under this subsection or any other provision of law shall remain in effect until the metropolitan planning organization is redesignated under paragraph 5, which is in the section. And under that same federal statute, the MPO may be redesignated by an agreement between the governor and the applicable units of general purpose of local government. So I'm a little bit concerned about this insertion of by agreement between the governor and local governments, because I believe that happens after an MPO has already been designated by federal code. You can redesignate it by agreement. And I just want to say that this particular court case also says the legislature shall not establish any law or policy about designating MPOs. And here we are, the legislature inserting language about designation of MPOs. So I just want to make sure we're not running afoul of this particular summary judgment nor federal code, and ensure that we don't try to replicate things in statute that we shouldn't be.
Matthew Harvey?
Yeah, for the record, Matthew Harvey, staff to Senator Kaufman. I think we have Legislative Legal Services online, and I think it was the intention to have them speak a little bit about the court case, and then as well as the Department of Transportation and the Department of Law. But I'll leave that up to the chair.
Oh, thank you. Yes, good pick up on that. So, we have Sean Lynch, Department of Law online, and also Ian Walsh with Ledge Legal online. Let's first go with Mr. Walsh. If you're there, if you could put yourself on the record.
For the record, this is Ian Walsh, Legislative Legal Services. Senator Tobin, through the chair, could the senator restate her question?
Thank you, Mr. Walsh. I'm most happy to try to stumble through it again. I have concerns that, one, we're establishing in statute the designation of how a metropolitan planning organization shall be established. That is already part of federal law that we'd just be replicating within state statute and maybe potentially running afoul of this summary judgment. And I'm also curious about how this section aligns with that summary judgment.
Yes. So Senator Chauvin, through the chair, to your first question, 23 U.S.C. 134 D1 is the federal law that provides how the original designation of an MPO would happen. And it provides sort of two mechanisms. D1A is by agreement between the governor and the units of general purpose local government that represent at least 75% of the affected population. So that is similar to or maybe the same as the redesignation standard that you mentioned. D1B says in accordance with procedures established by applicable state or local law. So I'm not sure that the amendment to add by agreement between the governor and local governments is necessary, because without that, we would default to the federal law. But I'm also not sure it conflicts with the federal law or the summary judgment decision, because the federal law explicitly provides for functionally the same procedure for creating an MPO.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And that's helpful to understand. I'm one that might shock a lot of folks. I like less prescriptive statute than more prescriptive, because I think it creates guardrails that later become deleterious toward good, effective governance. So if this is already established in U.S. code, I'm curious why we need to replicate it here. I think providing for that flexibility for how this might be redesignated within federal code, but yet codifying a state statute might create just too many barriers or too much prescription. But that's just a personal interest.
I would concur. We don't want to put in statute what doesn't need to be in statute. And I think if we look at back to the reason why this bill is before us today, we were dealing with widespread concern over the STIP process and over processes related to the STIP, newspaper articles about losing a construction season and everything else. But we don't want to do anything that creates further hindrance. So the do no harm should be the first thing that we look at. So do we have any further questions? Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this is my last question, I promise, either for the staff are carrying the legislation or for the department. This is on page 3, line 26. The one public member has been amended to say one member who is a community leader residing in an unorganized borough. And I'm curious to know what the decision from the department is in regarding why a community leader. I've heard from our boards and commissions that it's difficult finding folks to serve on our boards and commissions, and being more permissive in who we designate is helping them provide, hopefully to find someone. It doesn't mean we can't be more restrictive in how we do it, but just in terms of creating the statute, having a larger pool, I think would be a good thing.
Again, for the record, Andy Mills, DOT, and through the chair, Senator Tobin, I appreciate that question. The reason this was put forward is because the Aviation Advisory Board, we wanted to make sure we were comparing the structure of codifying this in statute with the Aviation Advisory Board, and it has that language. That's what we pulled that from. But certainly note the concern you have, and leader is a fairly broad term. So I
follow up. As long as we think we can find somebody, that to me is the most important part.
And just for those listening at home who may not have been in on conversations, it's seen that the Aviation Advisory Board functions very well, and it's seen as a valid model. So any other questions or follow-ups? So I'll take a few. So the CS received a significant fiscal note, and the analysis was fairly extensive, so a full backside of it. And I would just – we can't really grind deeply on every paragraph of it, but I would just kind of like to go through some of the assertions that are made in that, and the need for the fiscal note and the understandings, or at least the thoughts that went behind that.
Uh,
And just for the record, the fiscal note that we presently have was based on version A. So, Mr. Mills, if you would, do you want to just kind of run through the reasoning?
Mr. Chairman, I certainly am happy to. I also wanted to note, just for later, to be sure you know, with Mr. Lynch in the room, we certainly have some legal analysis to provide on the bill, should you want, and also on the court case as well. He is well informed on those subjects. So.
Yeah, and I misspoke before based on some notes that I had, but he is in the room, not online. And if you would like to have him join you for expediency, okay. That probably couldn't hurt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Appreciate that. So for the fiscal note, which again was drafted based on version A of the bill, we tried to run through the different provisions of that legislation. Really, the portion of the bill that we saw from a fiscal standpoint as having an impact was the requirement for the Roads and Highways Advisory Board to review projects. And again, we've touched on this a bit earlier, but we tried to give a very reasonable, and again, this was the low end. We tried not to create an overinflated idea of what the possible list could look like. So these were very modest numbers, and because again, we were just trying to say what we could reasonably assume from our regional directors on what some of the pre-construction estimates were for the number of projects possible. And again, the language is adjusted to May, which means that it's not shall as we saw in some previous drafts. And again, we would seek to define exactly where that start of pre-construction would be. And so we attempted to say, okay, to fully sort of staff this effort, yes, our project managers are producing information, but certainly a continued viability standard, which was, I believe, the language in version A, we would have to essentially write that definition of what continued viability might look like, what materials were they looking for, updated traffic analyses. I mean, we wondered what would be under the auspices of continued viability that this Roads and Highways Advisory Board would want to see to fully determine a recommendation on whether the project was viable moving forward or whether it should be closed. So we put into the fiscal note here that a transportation planner one, sort of entry-level planner, would be necessary to facilitate all the coordination and communication to prep, facilitate, and carry out the functions. Certainly, again, that was with the every two-year review, with 3 years being the marker. We would obviously want to revisit this with version B, which was 5, and version S, which was 8. So, thank you. Question?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Mills, I'm looking on page 2 of the fiscal note. Looks like between Northern Central and South Coast regions had listed 230-something projects that are past the 5-year mark right now. That are currently in pre-construction, not just past 5 years. Just as a way of comparison, could you give me a rough estimate as to how many we build each year?
I don't have a rough through the chair, Senator Myers. I don't have a rough estimate on the number of projects, but I can certainly look to get a number back to you. I know the number of projects that we put onto the sheets that we present, and that's somewhere around 40 to 60 a season, I think. But it's a wild guess at this moment, and I'd have to get back to you.
Okay, thank you.
So just kind of summing some of this is, so the question lies in the scope of work that the board is interfacing with, and there's definitions around that, and therefore the question is what's the actual amount of work that's being called for, and so I think as we define that, that may bring more light to the need or lack of need for the fiscal note. So if you would, there's some other issues that are in here.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Towards the bottom, we did want to mention two requirements, because it's not – when you're listing a fiscal note, we do want to give you what some of the hard or federal requirements tend to be. And so in this case, we are actually in the process right now of working with our federal partners on our stewardship and oversight agreement, an update to that. And it, as we do list in the fiscal note here, that in the stewardship and oversight, we actually do have a section that we cite that we agree in the stewardship and oversight agreement that on a case-by-case basis, we would need to provide addition when a significant new legislation, such as an executive order or other initiatives affecting the relationship or responsibilities of one or both parties to this agreement, that we would need to, following further down, adequately resource and provide capacity for that requirement that's placed on the department. So in this case, a may, we would generally have to look at what the extent of that could be and make sure that we are properly resourced to that. Certainly our project managers each have a significant workload. Our planners have significant areas that they're working on. As you probably have heard in other presentations, we have quite a bit of activity around the state, and I would not, I think you would understand, don't have a significant excess capacity to provide resourcing to the level that could be contemplated with, again, version A of the bill. And so we wanted to resource that adequately and try to give some of the underpinning requirements that the federal Fed Highways provides us that were rationale for resourcing it appropriately instead of just a pie in the sky guess, and that we are trying to put anything on this that would be deemed unnecessary.
Thank you. Any questions? I think the desire was, you know, again, the STIP processes are in regs that they came out of an administrative order, I believe, of what we're operating under right now. And so the desire is to get into statute what needs to be into statute and also provide some of the benefits that aviation now receives from a very functional board. So with the concerns that were kind of, I would say, elevated in the fiscal note, does the department feel that it's best to keep the STIP in regulation as it is now, as opposed to having it outlined in statute, the processes?
Mr. Chairman, I would love my lifeline, my second favorite lawyer in the state, to go ahead and take care of that particular question. I appreciate it.
Okay. Thank you. Please place yourself on the record and proceed.
Senator Hoffman, my name is Sean Lynch. I'm counsel for DOT with Transportation Section, Civil Division. I'm just going to give you a quick example of where having the STIP processes in state statute could complicate the development of the STIP. And the example was, and I'm sorry I don't have the section in front of me, but in the CS, there is the STIP shall be developed on a two-year cycle. In regulation, and what we're following right now, is 23 CFR, thank you, 450.218A is the requirement that there's the STIP must be developed every 4 years, and then here's the quote from it, or more frequently if the governor elects a more frequent update cycle. So that conflict there, where we have in statute a two-year cycle, and in currently without the statute, it's a four-year or a quicker cycle at the election of the governor. If we're trying to hit this two-year cycle and something gummed up the works, whatever it is, and possibly and someone with an interest in a project sued in the court and said, we've got to stop that STIP process until we figure out our project. That could run you over the line. Basically, in state law, the STIP's only good for 2 years. And so that limits the flexibility where in the statute, again, it's the governor's election. So for the second point here, to tear off that, the federal statutes and regulations recognize that this is all a planning process. There is no right to go to court. If this is all the people can once the planning document is adopted and we have a federal aid project, people have rights vis-a-vis that project. You know, the NEPA process, you can see what NEPA, there are all types of public interaction and judicial rights. But in the plan itself, it creates no rights. It's a planning document. It's just a public, you know, that coordinate. People are getting together and working through the issues and coming up with a list of projects to spend federal funds on. But there is no right to judicial review of that plan.
It's like you're spurring a question, Senator Tobin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And this might actually be a better question for Mr. Mills, because we've heard in recent testimony that the state is anticipating moving to a rolling STIP process. So I'm curious, is this something you can turn on and off if you want to do a rolling STIP today, but next year you want to go back to a four-year process? What is the nimbleness of that? Because it seems like the interest of moving to a rolling STIP actually aligns with what this legislation is trying to enshrine in statute, which is a support for that.
Through the chair, again, for the record, Andy Mills, DOT. Through the chair, Senator Tobin. So excellent question. This is a good one. Partially answered by letting you know that this morning we spent the morning with federal highway partners and some folks from Fed Highways from D.C. that were visiting, talking about the STIP and MPOs, and it was a great dialogue. We really have a solid partnership with those folks and continue to, even though there's a bit of a rough patch during the STIP, we certainly haven't been rebuilding and retooling those processes. For MPOs in particular, we talked about the need to align their planning cycles, their TIPs, with the STIP process. And right now, there is with a four-year process, there is a not great alignment, might be the way to put it. So by moving to a rolling STIP, we not only get into a cadence of getting ahead of the planning process where we don't get into the situation that we had, we also would look to realign the TIP, the MPO, Municipal Planning Organization, short-term transportation improvement plans, in that same cycle. And so we would see it as a beneficial refresh. What I believe Mr. Lynch was referring to is the general concern that if you create judicial relief as an option, again, maybe more politicized items or areas where people have a contention on something that's stipulated in statute, but the department doesn't have the flexibility on, could create an opening for yet one more thing that creates an impediment to getting the STIP done. That doesn't exist at the moment. All of the things outlined in the STIP section, 4442, all laudable and requirements that we acknowledge we have. But the concern, of course, would be any sort of additional openings in a judicial setting that would create impediments.
So I'll like to note we have Mr. Walsh too on the line, and we were hoping that we could get, you know, maybe just a brief overview from him. So if we could just shift to that. So Mr. Walsh, can you just give us, you know, your perspective on the court case Title 19?
For the record, this is Ian Walsh, Legislative Legal Services. Yes, Mr. Chair, through the chair, I would be glad to give an overview of the court case that Senator Tobin referenced earlier. I don't have a particular comment on the department's questions about judicial review. I don't think they're particularly related to the court case I'll be discussing, but if members have questions, feel free to ask them. So I'll just begin by explaining that this court case is a court case that was filed back in the early to mid-2000s dealing with the Anchorage area MPO. The MPO became effective, the operating unit became effective in 2002. And then in 2003 and 2004, the legislature passed two bills that had effects on the Anchorage MPO, which is called AMATS or AMAT. In particular, Senate Bill 260 attempted to change the composition of AMAT's policy board. The legislation required for areas with a population of 200,000 or more, so the only area that would affect at the moment is Anchorage, to change the composition of the policy board. And the legislation also included some intent language that purported to require the governor to enter an agreement with Anchorage to restructure the board according to the legislation. So this court case, Municipality of Anchorage v. State of Alaska, the Anchorage Superior Court decided that the changing of the composition of the policy board through Senate Bill 260 was a redesignation of the MPO of AMAS. And so then the court went through the federal law governing redesignation, which was referenced earlier. Senator Tobin mentioned it. Basically, federal law 23 U.S.C. 134 requires that the MPO may be redesignated by agreement between the governor and units of general purpose local government. And the Anchorage Superior Court concluded that SB 260 did not comply with this federal requirement because the changing of the composition of the policy board for AMAS was a redesignation by the legislature, and Anchorage did not agree to it, and indeed Anchorage sued to try to stop it. So the Superior Court held that the attempted redesignation in SB 260 was invalid, and I believe, and DOT should feel free to step in and correct me if I'm wrong if they get the opportunity, that the section of law enacted by SB 260, which one of them was 1920-210, which the CS proposes to repeal, is currently not being followed by AMAS because there was the redesignation that was attempted to be done by this was not valid. So the policy board of AMAS continues to not follow this statute, and this statute only currently, because it applies to populations greater than 200,000 persons, would only apply to the Anchorage area. I hope that helps the committee understand the court case.
Thank you. We appreciate that. Do we have any questions at this point? Okay. If no questions, we've kind of gone deep into the questions, but with intent. And so if it's the will of the committee, we can go ahead and adopt the committee substitute version S, and so as agreed. So with that, committee substitute for SB 263 version S has been adopted as our working document. And just continuing with our testifiers. So do we have any other questions for those that are testifying at this point? Let me check my notes briefly. Brief at ease. We're back on the record, and so Mr. Lynch, while we have you up, we'd like to get your any further input on the Title 19 changes, and Mr. Mills also, any comments that you have?
Sure. So for the record, Sean Lynch, I guess I wanted to make just one, or maybe a couple, but one clarification to Mr. Walsh's summary of the case. So the
if I could ask you to speak into your microphone.
The court's decision, well, just on the legislature's ability to designate the policy board. So, and there are two passages in here, and one's right on the first page, but I'll just read them both. But the court finds that the federal law amended in 2005 to specifically authorize the Alaska legislature to change the membership and selection of the AMATS policy committee without requiring municipal agreement. So Safety Lou was the federal law in 2005, has a standalone provision. It's section 4404. And actually, I'm going to flip to the body. So that was the finding, but in the decision itself. And this is on page 16. This court finds that Safety Lou, I'm adding that, it's section 440B, expressly accords the Alaska legislature the ability to bypass the redesignation requirement of 23 U.S.C. 134D5 that specifies that redesignation of MPOs can only occur with the agreement of the governor and the affected local government. So if I can just put that into layman's term,
please.
The legislature has the power to create the policy board in the way that it chooses. That's the legislative power that was, and I believe Safety Lou 4404 only applies. That's a specific Alaska and Hawaii carve out, but it gives the Alaska legislature the power to do this. So currently, the repeal of AS 1920-210, which gives the standard for the policy board, the legislature under this decision and under that law is completely has the full power to do that. Can remove all standards, can modify that policy board. So this decision found that law. That law gives the legislature the power. The issue that was left open, well, the two other findings, one is at the time of the decision, AMATS was organized in a way that it said the municipality was the MPO rather than the policy board. So it was in conflict with the law. So that part where it says it found for the state and counts one and two, that's what that's about. That's now been changed. They've revised their operating agreement. What the parties did, and the state and the municipality, and here I'm just going to flip to page 6 of the decision. So the parties filed a joint stipulation and order for preliminary injunction. And pursuant to that stipulation, this court entered a preliminary injunction that enjoined the state from taking any action to enforce the disputed provisions of SB 260 and SB 271, pending further order of the court. What the parties jointly decided, they weren't going to follow AS 1920-210. The way that AMATS reconfigured itself, everyone just said, good enough. The legislature said, do one thing. The parties said, we're good enough.
We're moving on. Was that?
But the law, kind of the legal standards here, is the legislature can designate. So we all, which I believe also means the power to remove that, whatever those policy board requirements are. And
I need to move you along. Okay, we're running short of time.
Okay, and that injunction, since it only enjoined AS 1920-210, if you remove that, it removes it all. So the redesignation requirements, if there are any, the court never decided that. So we'd have to figure out if the policy board would have to reconstitute itself. That's
I do want to open public testimony and get through that. So if we could, we'll just go through that. So I'll now open public testimony on SB 263. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify? It appears there's no one in the room. Is there anyone in the LIO or on the phone that would like to testify? It appears not. So with that, I will close public testimony. So I think just kind of in wrap up, and then we'll move on to the next item of business. So Mr. Mills, do you have any kind of further closing statements, any observations?
Again, for the record, Andy Mills, DOT. So Mr. Chairman, I certainly see the provisions of the legislation is trying to do right by the department and the state. There's just so many considerations when we started reviewing the legal review. So we certainly look forward to providing more information to the committee as the sponsor or anyone else to try and get this into a spot. So thank you.
Thank you. I would say if there's any points that you feel did not get made, please feel free to submit them to the committee, and we'll pass them to the other members. Committee members, do you have any final questions, any last-minute thoughts? All right. So I appreciate that. And so we will now move on to our next order of business, and we'll take a brief at ease. That we're back on the record, and next we'll move to House Bill 395 by the House Transportation Committee. This first hearing of HB 395 today is my intention to hear a bill introduction, take invited testimony, set the bill aside for further consideration. With that, I'd like to invite Representative McCabe and his staff, Julie Morris, to come forward to present an introduction of the bill.
Good afternoon, Chair Kaufman and members of the Senate Transportation Committee. Thank you for hearing HB 395. For the record, my name is Representative Kevin McCabe, representing House District 30, and with me is my staff, Julie Morris, who will read the sectional analysis if you so desire. House Bill 395 aims to facilitate the transfer of land from the Alaska Railroad Corporation to the City of Nenana. This bill is the first step in allowing the City of Nenana to work with the Alaska Railroad, or vice versa, the Alaska Railroad in this case, to work with the City of Nenana and their board, the Railroad Board, in finalizing this transfer. This will be a pivotal moment for the City of Nenana and its residents, who have diligently managed and invested in this land since 1981. Over the years, the City has poured approximately $29 million into developing infrastructure on this land. And this substantial investment underscores the City's commitment to fostering economic growth in their region. By acquiring ownership of this land, the municipality seeks to leverage its assets to catalyze further economic growth and development. The strategic location of this land cannot be overstated. Situated near the river system, the Alaska Railroad, the Parks Highway, and the Nenana Airport, it serves as a vital transportation hub with immense potential for industrial development. Central to the city's development plan is the Nenana Municipal Boat Launch, a critical piece of infrastructure that provides access to rivers such as the Tanana, Totatlanika, Teklanika, Tolovana, Kantishna, and the Yukon. I managed to get through those without stuttering.
Good job.
The city has invested $300,000 in the boat launch alone, demonstrating its commitment to enhancing transportation infrastructure for both commercial and recreational purposes. House Bill 395, however, is not merely about transferring land. It's about empowering the City of Nenana to take ownership of the resources that it has diligently managed and invested in for decades. This legislation will enable the city to pursue its economic development goals more effectively and utilize key infrastructure assets for the benefit of the community and the region as a whole. House Bill 395 will provide the City of Nenana, as it strives to unlock the full potential of its resources and pave the way for a brighter, more prosperous future for all its residents. So off script a little bit here, I'd like to say that this is just the first step. We are required, the legislature is required by law, anytime there is a land transfer from the Alaska Railroad, we sort of initiate the process. We give them permission to go forward, and then their board takes it and they negotiate with whoever wants to buy the land. They provide for the surveying, they provide for everything involved with the sale, and then the two parties do it together with their board approving the final approval for the sale. So the city of Nenana has more. I was asked this question on the floor the other day, and I didn't have a really good answer, but I do now. The city of Nenana has more invested in this property already than just the boat launch. There is a gravel pit there that they are using. There are some storage areas there for logs and that sort of thing for railroad. The railroad depot is on that piece of land that I don't know how many of you were at the 100th anniversary, but that depot is part of Nenana, and it's actually on the railroad land. So I have a number of different projects that they are managing right now that are on that land, and all they seek to do right now is to purchase that land from the railroad, and the railroad seems to be amenable to that. So this is just the first step. Happy to have Ms. Morris go through the sectional if you desire, or answer questions.
Please, I think we'll go straight to the sectional. Let's roll through that, and then we'll do some questions, as well as we also have Mayor Josh Verhagen and others online, so we'll get their input as well.
Thank you, Chairman Kaufman, and for the record, Julie Morris, staff to represent McCabe. I'll read the sectional analysis into the record. Section 1 amends uncodified law of the state of Alaska by amending a new section that approves the transfer of real property to the city of Nenana. The Alaska Railroad Corporation is authorized to convey the interest in the surface estate of approximately 188 acres of the rail land to the city of Nenana and provides for the legal description of the property conveyed. Section 2 provides for the effective date under AS 0110070C, and that is the sectional.
All right. Thank you very much. And so any questions at this point for the sponsor or staff? And so with that, we'll go to the mayor. So if you would please place yourself on the record and proceed with any testimony that you may have.
All right, can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, for the invitation to testify today. For the record, my name is Josh Verhagen, and I am the mayor of the city of Nenana. I want to thank the Senate committee for taking up this bill in such a timely manner. I know session is nearing an end, and so this is a significant project that will make a huge impact on the future of my community, and it'd be wonderful to have this finalized yet this year. I wanted to start out by saying thank you to the Alaska Railroad for working with us these last few years. I truly appreciate their communication and willingness to look to come to win-win solutions. The goal here is to acquire a portion of land owned by the Alaska Railroad that's not used for railroad operations, but that makes up most of the waterfront property surrounding Nenana, and that has been developed by the city and its subleasees. So for context, the city is currently in the midst of a 55-year lease with the Alaska Railroad on this approximate 188 acres of land, and we have about 13 years left to go on that lease. We are one of the only inland ports in the state of Alaska, and our community has had a long-standing history of barging. On this property, we have an office building for Rail Belt Mental Health and Addictions. We have a cultural center and gift shop. We have an artisan market. We have the offices for the Nenana Ice Classic Association. We also have a warehouse and public works facilities. One of the most significant things is we have our wastewater treatment facility for our public utility. We also have, as was mentioned, a gravel mining operation. We have storage for barge operations. We have a boat launch, the railroad depot, and another utility storage building. So quite a lot of infrastructure that's been put in, invested in over the years that provides a lot of services for the community. And this summer, actually, we have an 8-station Tesla charging, a Tesla charging station being installed on a parking area on this piece of property. So there's a lot been put in. We also have a lot of interest, significant interest from investors who hope to bring some industry to our port, such as a large scale sawmill, an energy efficient home kit manufacturing facility, recreation, tourism activities, and more. And one of the hesitations thus far from some of these investors has been that the city is not the owner of the land. And they have stated that they would be more likely to put their investment here if that was to be the case. So as was stated, the city has put in approximately $29 million into this port land. And our lease does have first right of refusal that allows us to purchase if the land were ever to be put up for sale. The land never has been put up for sale by the railroad, but efforts have been made toward this since the 1980s. And in 1995, the then mayor, Jack Coghill, had introduced an item on the ballot to take out a bond to purchase this land that passed, and the community showed their support for acquiring this land. But at the time, there was never a bill that authorized for this purchase to happen. Nothing happened from that point until about 2019. A few months after I got elected, I went down to Juneau and met with the governor and talked to the governor about the possibility of supporting an effort like this. In 2020, there was a bill introduced by Senator John Coghill, SB 219, proposed this transfer. And so that, unfortunately, was about 2 weeks before COVID shut everything down. The bill, along with many others, died. Some efforts were put back into it in 2021 and 2022, and so kind of brings us to present. There was a HB 199 that was introduced, and there was some misunderstanding about first right of refusal and some of the other investments on the property. But here we are to HB 395, and I want to thank Representative McCabe and his staff for all their work in helping us to get here. For financial matters, when I took office 6 years ago, the city had approximately $10.5 million of debt. With a whole lot of diligence and perseverance, we've eliminated about 95% of that debt. And the only remaining debt that we have is with the Lost Railroad, and that's for just under about $700,000. And so with the goal of being debt-free, this bill would really help us to cross that finish line. I'm requesting funds from the legislature, and there's no fiscal note attached to this bill. Instead, we intend to work out the details of the purchase with the Alaska Railroad and their board. And though the details of the purchase aren't being worked out here before this committee, I do think it would be helpful for you to know that if not all, at least part, if not all of the purchase will be because of our investors, and one of which who testified on to the Transportation Committee on April 19th and talked about his interest in moving his home manufacturing business to our park. And interested, there are some letters of support from him and these other investors. So lastly, the city's working hard to become self-sufficient and self-sustaining, and we believe that by having some of these economic development projects occurring on the port, it'll help to provide jobs, housing, and the revenue that our community's been needing for decades. And due to our significant investments, the services we provide on the property to the community, and the many instances of lost investment opportunities from the private sector, that owning this land beneath all of this infrastructure would be a huge benefit to the community. I thank you for the opportunity to testify. testify today and would greatly appreciate the legislature's support for this issue that I believe will turn the tide for Neenah's economic future. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Mayor Verhagen. Do members have any questions for the mayor? Looks like we have none. Seeing no further questions, I want to also note that we have Ms. Christy Terry and Megan Clemens with the railroad. And it looks like we also have Brian Lindemood, chief engineer, online. Do any of the folks online have any comments, or does the committee have any questions for those? Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure if this should be for the railroad or for Mayor Verhagen, maybe both. Just curious, since Representative McCabe mentioned that this is step one of getting the land transferred, assuming that we pass this bill by the end of this session here in a couple of weeks, approximately when do we think that sale would be completed?
To the chair, this is Megan Clemens, External Affairs Director with the Alaska Railroad, and I'd be hesitant to put a timeline on it, but you know, I can speak to some of the other essential parts of the process. So, you know, typically when we start a discussion around a transfer of Alaska Railroad land, that'll start with a staff review and discussions with the other entity in question. We've already started those discussions with the city of Neenah in identifying, you know, the land in question, what we think might make sense that we no longer need from an operating standpoint that the city of Neenah would be interested in. As Representative McCabe noted, legislative approval is certainly an important and necessary part of the process. So, you know, receiving that approval will be essential in moving this forward, but certainly still surveying the land remains, as well as appraising the land. And once we have that information and the city of Neenah has that information and is still interested in moving forward, then we bring that to the Alaska Railroad Board of Directors for their review and approval. And from there, pending the board approval, you know, there's a lot that goes into a sale transaction, you know, at that fair market value that all parties would be looking at. So, I mean, again, hesitant to put a timeline on it, but realistically, probably still a couple of years away, I think would be fair. And I'll look to my colleague, Christy Terry, our VP of Real Estate, to correct me if she's got a different opinion on that.
Ms. Terry, do you have any comments?
To the chair, through the chair to the committee. No, that is a good representation of the steps moving forward. I might just add that, you know, our board is going to have to make some findings. One, that the land is not necessary for railroad purposes. And we've already worked with the city to be very specific about the property description. So I think we have that covered for the board to review, and that the sale of the land is in the best interest of the state. So there are a few things that our board will have to assess and weigh in on.
Thank you. Any follow-up or further questions? And so seeing no further questions, Representative McCabe, do you have any closing remarks or any final thoughts?
Thanks, Chair Kaufman, for hearing this bill, and thanks for the invited testifiers. You know, one of the things that excited me about this whole project was the one of the investors that Mayor Verhagen has attracted is a guy from the Kenai Peninsula who is now logging up there around Neenah, and he seeks to kind of slow down Senator Myers, but the trucking between Neenah and the Kenai, and move his business up there. They have wide open area, but the best part about it is he manufactures pre-built homes that can be actually put up in about 5 days. So imagine, if you will, a village needs a home for a trooper somewhere on, you know, Ruby, say they need a home for a trooper, or Galena or something like that. They can manufacture this home, put it on a barge, have it there in a couple of days, and put it up in 5, 6, 8 days. So it solves, it goes a little bit, it's not the panacea, no doubt, but it goes a little bit to solving the thing that we've heard about numerous times from the troopers and the teachers: we need housing in our villages. So to me, it seemed like a win-win, or at least, you know, for this, that portion of it, and it kind of excited me. So I was happy to hear that Mayor Verhagen did the work on that and the legwork, and that there's an investor actually interested in it. Also, with the airport there, the railroad there, and the major, the Parks Highway there, it just seems to be a nexus for good things. So I appreciate you hearing the bill, and I look forward to seeing how it moves through.
Appreciate that. All right. Any final comments from the committee? Questions? No. Well, seeing none, I'm going to set this bill aside for further consideration. And with no further questions or comments, I want to thank the committee members for being here and all of our testifiers. We appreciate it. And I want to also thank the committee records LIO support staff who helped today's committee meeting run smoothly. So with that, this meeting is now adjourned at 2:48 p.m.